Our keynote address this morning is by Didier Sarnet. Didier is professor and chair of Entrepreneurial Risks, Department of Management, Technology, and Economics at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology. He's also the director of the Financial Crisis Observatory in Switzerland. He'll be speaking to us about innovation and collaboration in complex social and economic systems.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I come to you as I would call a specialist of crisis in industrial structures, in earth sciences, in social systems like stock markets or even the brain or immune system, but I should call myself more a generalist. So I'm going to share with you today a few remarks, making parallels between finance, their crisis, their maybe solutions, and let's say healthy food, healthy medication, healthy living. So first, the good news. There are, of course, immense progress and innovations in both systems where, you know, financial development and banking has fostered the use of, you know, economic development, welfare, education, and you see on this graph, and I'm going to shoot at you. I hope you are seated comfortably in your table. You had a comfortable breakfast. I'm going to shoot at you a lot of graphs, a lot of data to support my discussion. So you see a graph of the accelerating financial market values across many international markets over the last 200 years on the left-hand side. And the right-hand side, you see similarly, of course, great improvements, for example, from food, better feeding, better healthcare, in decreasing newborn and infant mortality, or height increase, as you see in the bottom graph, as a proxy for health. And this has led, again, on the left, on the financial aspect, to a super Malthusian growth of population. Here, the scale is such that a straight line should qualify an exponential Malthusian growth. Actually, the human population, as well as GDP over the last 2,000 years, has actually grown faster than exponential with growth rate accelerating as a basis on the basis of innovations, feeding, and having positive feedback on future innovation and so on. And on the right, you see also the increase of longevity in the top graph on the right, as well as actually increase of differences, showing that the more wealthy people, of course, have a kind of large, much larger height as a proxy of better health. So that's a positive view. Now, what about the problems? Many, many problems. And I'm going to go back and forth between both and to discuss the different aspects and maybe ideas of solutions. In the financial system, there's a beautiful article by Mr. Bogon, who was the former CEO of Vanguard, one of the largest fund in the U.S., managing more than $1 or $1.5 trillion, who in Journal of Portfolio Management summarized this big, overwhelming loss of the fiduciary principle, the fact that actually bankers in the financial industry overall have not followed their role of serving their clients. This fiduciary principle is simply the legal relationship of confidence and trust between two parties that have been exploited with so-called moral relativism, moral hazard, and the problem of misaligned incentives that has led to so many problems culminating in the crisis which we know. I would like to propose that there is a similar problem in the food and healthcare, which is the loss of the principle, let's say, of the filling of the Hippocratic oath, which can be summarized by the fact that when you look at the problem, there is a fundamental conflict of interest. Of course, if you look at economic rational agents trying to work in the healthcare and food industry, they have, of course, the maximizing drive to keep us all marginally ill so that we can earn money and pay for the bills. This is just maximizing shareholder values, even if the goal of companies is to develop, I mean, one professed goal that we teach to our students is to develop a sustainable long-term growth. But actually, it's very perfectly irrational to focus on short-term in the presence of large risk and large uncertainties which characterize a business, of course. So that's one major problem with the conflict interest. And let me show you a little bit the consequence of that in various graphs. For example, in finance, this has led to the enormous growth of the financial industry, and this has to be put in perspective in the last more than 150 years, where you see the share of the U.S. financial industry in terms of GDP in the, from, you know, with a peak culminating in 1929, then the crash, the Great Depression, a plateau roughly over 50 years, and then resuming of an acceleration of the size of the banking industry. Actually, when you look at the salaries of the bankers, they follow exactly the same parallel graph. In the UK, for example, in the last 10, 50, 20 years, the growth of GDP has only be fed by the growth of financial industry, with zero growth in the manufacturing industry, or actually even decrease. And the rate of and the amount of profit, corporate profit, sum over all the industries, has been completely dominated by the financial profits, almost making half of the global corporate profits, as opposed to what actually you produce in terms of goods and selling. Of course, in the pharmaceutical industry, there's a lot of problems. For example, I'm taking this data from Bloomberg, which I would say not a journal against the financial developments of the field, which report the accelerating bills that pharmaceutical companies have to pay in fines. Here, just in the last 5 years, they report $7 billion in fines and penalties for illegal off-label marketing. A lot of issues with the links with education, of training of doctors, and so on. This is perfectly rational optimization of economic agents. And actually, we had this paper, this op-ed in the Financial Times 2 years ago with my colleague, Yannick Malavern, where we basically stated something like this qualitative theorem that when you have optimizing agents who work in highly complex, uncertain, regulated environment with basically mathematical frameworks, the system is confined by boundaries, quite complex constraints, then almost always you'll find that the optimal solution is at the border, at the boundary, so at the limit of the regulations. Of course, the regulations are so complex, it means in the first the limits. And of course, this leads to excesses, creative accounting, moral hazard, conflict of interest, and so on. So it's a very deep, ingrained structure in the very sense of optimizing systems. And actually, when you look at why this is permeating these different fields, you can find, of course, a lot of studies. One I would like to borrow from is this justification theory, where people actually like to justify the existing order. For example, it's well known that disadvantaged groups internalize inferiority and actually manifest in-group favoritism to enhance self-esteem, to actually keep stability and certainty, which is one of the big fears, to lose certainty, the safety feeling, and facilitate relationship. So we can think of this as a process to support this, inappropriate behavior. Now, that was the first point, conflict of interest, rational agent optimizing. Second point is human intrinsic weakness, while people simply fail to do what is best even for themselves in the face of good, freely available information, overeating, alcohol, smoking, and so on and so forth. How does it translate in finance? Well, this is maybe summarized what I call the illusion of the perpetual money machine. So when you look at the bottom graph, which shows in percentage of GDP, and the data is some for the U.S., and the top data is for U.S., Europe, and Japan, as a percentage of GDP, you see the wage, which are plateauing until the 1980s, and then slightly decreasing in proportion of GDP, as opposed to consumption, which has been increasing, you know, shooting up from the level of about 60-65% to 75 or so percent of. So how do you consume more while earning the same amount or even less? Well, the top graph gives the solution. You save a bit less, and you have another income, which is the financial profit, financial investment. And this is very well demonstrated by, for example, the amount of wealth extraction as documented by Alan Greenspan himself in these graphs that show that at the peak in 2005, 2006, more than $1 trillion was extracted yearly by this mortgage equity refinancing. And when you remove that in the right graph from the GDP growth of the U.S., you find that actually the growth didn't exist, basically. Everything was coming from this perpetual money machine of increasing real estate price, giving you a sense of, not you, but the American, a sense of wealth. They could extract money by renegotiating and investing and consuming and so on and so forth. Is it sustainable? Yes, as long as the real estate grows. Now, this is colliding against a fundamental accounting conservation law, I could call it, if I use my background as a physicist, like the conservation of energy. You know, overall, it's impossible that investment for all of us can grow faster than the growth of GDP, because GDP counts everything. Over the last 50 years in developed countries, the growth has been about 2% in real terms. So anyone promising that it's possible for pension funds, for example, to face their liabilities, to they have to get 8, 10% a year, this is an accounting, fundamental accounting impossibility. And the 25 years that the U.S. have endured, or not endured, has benefited from until 2006, has been extraordinary in the sense of very no or very weak recessions, extraordinary growth, but it has been at the expense, as we know, of extraordinary increase of debt, in particular the private sector, so that each dollar of debt has been less and less efficient in growing the GDP. So this illusionary quest of society at large, of pension funds, of mutual funds, of all of us, to gain more than 2% of real terms is one of these intrinsic weaknesses that we have, not recognizing these limits. We can summarize this as the gambling society, the stardom culture, the emphasis on luck rather than work and risk management. And this is maybe one of the major causes of the crisis, which is our illusion of the financial solution to growth as opposed to real economic development. If I make now a jump to the food and health care, I would say that a similar illusion, which is the, I call it the illusion syndrome of blue pills and red pills, so that every problem that we have can be solved by just, you know, a few medication. This is well in resonance with the principle of least effort that actually describe a lot of our contemporaries. The principle of immediate or short-term gratification. Many economists describe the American as a people of teenagers, for example, in their decisions in terms of economic terms. And the root cause of the economic healthcare crisis is probably our illusion of technical and medical innovations. So bankers have exploited this. They are sellers of the dreams that I just referred to. They exploit our illusion and our cognitive limitations, like, of course, in extreme case, of the casinos and lotteries. And I'm just borrowing a graph from Tversky, another Nobel Prize winning work. Unfortunately, he died before getting the Nobel Prize that Kahneman got, where our subjective probabilities are very, very different from our objective probabilities. In the food and healthcare system, I would say there is a similar exploitation of the weakness, for example, addiction, compulsory nature of foods, and the illusion of the simple solution to health problem. Second point. Now, my third point. I believe that most of the dynamics, interesting dynamics, and crises are of very strong endogenous nature. On the left side, I'm listing a few systems, and in particular, the one which are bracketed in red are those that we have in our group studied quantitatively, to identify the nature of the endogenous self-organization that led to the shock, to the crisis, to the collapse. On the right-hand side, you see a similar proposition of different systems that could be of interest from this endogenous view. Of course, I'm not negating, for example, in the case of the immune system, the illness, that there are no virus or bacteria, that there are no gene effects. Obviously, there are a lot of structure, but there's also a lot to put into the dynamics self-organization of the system in the presence of a constant flux of pathogens. In the finance case, this is very well illustrated by the data from the Hong Kong Hang Seng market, which is probably the freest market in the world, the closest to the textbook example of a free market where people can invest, sell, put their capital in and out. And what you see in this graph, 30 years of data of 14% growth, punctuated by 8 major bubbles and crashes, This system is endogenously generated instabilities. Overall, it's growing at 14%, but it's constantly super exponentially accelerating by positive feedback and then crashing. Now, why? How do we understand that? Well, positive feedbacks. These two graphs show the difference between the standard equilibrium view on the left and what is happening during a time when positive feedback dominates, where as the price goes up, the demand grows, which is exactly the opposite as what you would expect from an equilibrium point of view. This can be, and this would be my only equation, can be captured by a simple equation like this one, where rather than having proportional growth, you have super proportional growth, where the growth rate is fed by the demand when the price goes up, and this gives rise to monsters like this super exponential growth of human population by the feedback of humans creating new innovations. And so this has led to a program in our team to actually identify these mechanisms and these, features announcing this crisis. The positive feedback mechanisms are many in finance. They are both technical as well as behavioral, in particular herding. We are mainly herding animals and actually rational to imitate in absence of enough information. And this leads to another picture of the crisis that we are still suffering the consequence from, which is the superposition of 5 or 6 bubbles that have accumulated over time, from the ITC bubble that crashed in 2000, the action of the Fed, the real estate bubble that developed in various parts of the world, the many financial bubbles, the stock market bubble, the commodity oil bubbles, all this leverage culminating in a proportion that led to this enormous instability that we are still fighting the hangover from. And this is an example of the type of analysis that we are doing in our Financial Crisis Observatory to monitor these coming instabilities. Jumping back to health sciences, we are developing also in my team this research program in terms of the endogenous view, and we have developed a simple framework, simplified framework to classify the interplay between immune system dynamics and pathogens and structure by genes, so that we develop this model in terms of dynamical homeostasis, which is similar or in ambition to what is needed in the financial industry, which needs to develop this dynamical out-of-equilibrium view in order to be useful for the future understanding of the financial economy. So what possible solution in the last few minutes I have, what possible solutions or ideas I can propose in order to foster the future discussion? Well, we think immediately that we should promote, you know, high tech and so on, but what about the problem of memory loss? And let me just mention very fast the fact that we knew the solution in 1933. This was called the Glass-Steagall Act that had been repealed slowly from the 1980s and committed in 1999, which is simply to compartmentalize the industry of finance so that we don't have the Titanic effect of cascade, of domino effect. We also have lost the knowledge that banks create credit out of nowhere. This actually, with very economists who are old enough, in the 50s or large or more older, they remember this was in textbook. This is not found anymore in the textbooks, and this is one of the major mechanisms of instability of banks, this credit creation. And so I join Paul Krugman when he says, well, maybe we just need to solve the problem by making banking boring again. Now, in terms of healthy life, I propose the hypothesis that, I don't know exactly the number, that something I would like really to know better, maybe 90% of mental health problems come from forgetting so simple, low-tech, grandmother-like recipes. So I'm going to be boring here. Deep breathing, drink a lot of water, outside meals, digestion start with the mouth, chew a lot, exercise every morning 10 minutes, low chemistry, don't combine alkaline and acid food. It's a complete mistake from a chemistry point of view. As a physicist, of course, you should not do that. Eat a lot of raw vegetables and fruits, eat less meat, and develop positive psychology, get a companion or cat. It has been known scientifically that they are very good doctors. Socialize. Let me finish with the Wharton ideas for thought. The Wharton solution, you know, known not for their known for their economic thinking. There is one idea that the incentives are, of course, completely wrong for everyone, including providers, payers, and patients. So the company should not make the decision, but the consumer should make the decision. That's one idea. Another one, again by Wharton people, is we should actually pay the people to be healthy. Very interesting idea. And I go back to the old Chinese way that I learned from some Chinese colleagues, that actually they were paying their physician and their provider of health only when they were healthy. Of course, this happens a lot of issues about the government role in innovation versus free market. Let me finish with the idea of promoting sustainable behavior by social capital, with what we have in our mind, like very strong reciprocal effect, fairness, altruism, and order regarding behavior that rule the world, but not the free market. We need to develop self-sustained incentive to foster the social capital, and field studies, lab experiments, agent-based model can help a lot in order to understand this. And there are many examples. Eunice will speak about that, of course, tomorrow. The examples of application of this social capital in action for eBays, even in the banking industry, some funds have developed this combined free market approach as well as trust and altruistic approach remarkably. And Switzerland. So to summarize, I've tried to make four points. One is this parallels between finance and health with this fundamental conflict of interest and misincentive. The second one, this weakness of humans, principle of least effort, and the illusory money machine, pill solution, the endogenous versus exogenous origins of crisis and problems, and the solution, which is clearly a mixture of old forgotten recipes plus social capital and innovation. Thank you.
In one of your slides, you talk about in the presence of competition and regulation that the equilibrium is always found on the margin, if I understand correctly. Could this be in the context of food and marketing and so on, the balance between regulation and industry or community initiative is one of the very important policy issues? Is there any insights to get from the observation that you make of the financial systems in this regard?
So this result holds for optimizing agents, right? I would say, we have to look at in the details of this problem, the specificity in each field, before we make a translation, right, or transfer of concepts. But I would claim that this key idea of, there are two ideas. Okay, first, optimizing agents. As soon as you have a lot of constraints, the solution will be close to the border. So it has consequences. Secondly, in finance, these people are highly, very clever, highly motivated, the best paid in the world, fighting against regulators who are much lower paid, less motivated. So who wins? Much better lawyers. So it's very clear. So the third idea, rebounding on your question, is should we always optimize? Nature does not optimize. Our body does not optimize. We are robust. We have some parts like the eye, which is at the quantum limit. It's like an optimization limit. But many other parts are suboptimal but very robust. We know that the brain, for example, the way it works, is not optimal compared to a computer or supercomputer. The memory is dispersed, is very robustly dispersed in many, many neurons. So we don't go to the full capacity, but we are very robust. So we can destroy part of the brain, still become functional. So I think one of the problems of our society and our economy is the weakness with respect to this drive to optimize, which is also rational from a short-term perspective, but at the cost of robustness, as we have seen with the crisis. So these are the three remarks, maybe two.
Is there one more question? Good morning. Thank you for your presentation. Very early in your talk, you mentioned that consumers don't always do what's best for them. And yet part of the solution, let's say the Wharton solution, is that consumers should make their own health decisions. How do we bridge that gap between the innate tendencies not to take care of themselves and then looking to solutions for consumers to go ahead and take control? Just like your thoughts on that.
Enormous question. So I made a few suggestions. So, for example, we know that we are social animals. So, you know, all the social aspects, I mean, these are, as you know, programs to help people become less addictive in many ways by being embedded in the social. So one big thing, for example, that evolutionary psychology and anthropology have taught us is that we were evolved in our brain and our body to cope with about 100, 150 people. And that's a Dunbar number, and we developed this. There's actually a hierarchy. So we are in a society, the global village, where we are, you know, Facebook, tens of thousands of friends. Actually, no, I mean, we know that there's a lot of studies confirming that we are living through this transition, which is destabilizing. So in order to, I mean, this is a huge question. I don't know even how to attack it. It is a systemic problem where, depending on the situation, the geography and so on, you are going to propose different things. In particular, I think one of the most important one is motivation of people and embedding in the right social group and fostering the social group, you know, from the bottom up to the macro level. And this is something that is, of course, there are communities who do this and so on, but this is a never-ending problem. This is an out of equilibrium situation. It's an unbalanced situation. It's like the financial market. We have this belief that the financial market is intrinsically efficient. I mean, this is what we learn in textbook. This is, you know, the standard view. This Minsky hypothesis, you may have heard about this economist who proposed the financial instability hypothesis. And I believe this is true. From all of the work we have been doing in my group, we find that India and the Hong Kong market was a really exemplary example of this, that when markets are left alone, they become unstable. So I think this is true also for human society, and there are regulation processes that we are constantly to relearn because we forget them. I showed several examples, Glass-Steagall Act, the credit creation of banks in the financial industry. We have been lost, and we are trying to reinvent things for which we know the solution of. So it's a mixture of new innovations. I see so many new innovations that destroy past knowledge and are actually suboptimal. So sorry, it's a bit disorganized, but it's a so difficult a question, of course.
Okay,
thank you for your question.